from high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot going on today. This hour, we're going to be joined by Brett Baer and Congressman Jody Arrington, House Budget Committee Chair. We're also trying to get some money to see about these series of storms and who's going to be paying for them. Suddenly, we realize HHS Secretary came out out of nowhere 2 weeks ago and said, yeah, we're out of money. Okay, we'll see. And he's also calling on Congress to come back. Don't think he has that type of power. He certainly doesn't have the respect from Republicans in the House. So before we get to Brett, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
No, think about it. He thinks Vladimir Putin is his friend. What about the American people? They should be your first friend.
But if Donald Trump, even if it's true, look, is there something wrong with speaking to world leaders?
Here he goes again. Bob Woodward, a new tell-all book, is out with revelations, creating quite an uproar from Putin to Trump to Biden to Obama to, I don't know what it's about, Harris. If true, a lot of nerves will be rubbed raw.
Number two.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Really? Okay. That's a bit of a surprise. The Harris media blitz continues, and her boss, Biden, who attempted to rally his base when he was in trouble, she seems to be doing the same thing and creating problems with her lack of answers, inability to display knowledge, and handle issues. Meanwhile, Trump's battleground blitz of his own barrels through the Midwest, two stops in Pennsylvania.
Number one.
How confident are you that FEMA will have what it needs to take care of impacted Americans moving forward?
Very confident. We have demonstrated that in response to Hurricane Helene with an extraordinary breadth of resources.
There you go. That's HHS Secretary Mayorkas. Milton, a massive hurricane expected to slam the west coast of Florida any hour now, maybe a little bit later on this afternoon, early evening. It'll happen today. 2 weeks ago, Helene did the same. How has the federal and state governments responded, and could this be the October surprise of a natural phenomenon? With me right now is Brett Baer. Brett, a lot of people you know are in Florida. You have a house in Florida. How worried should people be?
Yeah, I think it's serious. You know, I mean, we've seen storms. This is a big one. You know, it's going to probably lose a little steam wind-wise before it hits, but it's really the storm surge. And if you know, with Senator Rubio, who said that he had a briefing years ago by Hurricane Center and FEMA, you know, what's their worst case scenario? And it's actually hitting into that Tampa area because of the low-lying areas. So it looks like it's jogging a little south. I've got a mom in Naples. I've got a lot of friends in Naples. Some of them are hunkering down. And I think they're going to, you know, they got to just be careful because this is a big one.
It is. And we'll continue to watch it. And, of course, we're monitoring it all over. And we've got Fox Weather. I want to talk about something I didn't think I was talking about. I didn't think he was working on another book. But Bob Woodward comes out with a book, at which time it says Biden has a lot of friction with Netanyahu, calls him a liar, tells him not to go into Lebanon. He does. Ask him what the game plan he was. He said Netanyahu would only say, I'm going into Rafah. He said, that's not a good strategy. He's upset by that. And he goes on to say that, according to Bob Woodward, that he blames Obama for the problems in Ukraine. He said he underestimated Vladimir Putin, let him take Crimea and didn't really prepare for it, and let him build up intelligence and do what he did. I've never heard Biden really go at Obama, but this is going to be tough to shake.
Yeah, I mean, he's not wrong there. I mean, there's a lot of foreign policy experts who say how that was handled and, you know, drawing a red line and then kind of letting Crimea go was not the right way to do it. Obviously, Vice President Biden was in that administration when it happened, but it is interesting to see that he's blaming President Obama. Obviously, there's other things in that book that are raising a lot of eyebrows, including this allegation that President Trump gave COVID testing machines to Vladimir Putin and that he's talked to him seven times since leaving the presidency. That's something that the Trump campaign and the Trump folks say is not true. But it's, you know, you add all of this stuff up, and there are nuggets in here that Bob Woodward gets in a Bob Woodward way that I'm sure is going to cause a stir in some way or another.
Yeah, they say it's one Trump staffer who remains anonymous that said he called about seven times. In terms of the Obama says we blanked up in 2014. That's why we're here. We blanked it up. Barack never took Putin seriously. We did nothing. We gave Putin a license to continue. Well, I'm revoking that license. They also said they got pristine intelligence, even from somebody on the inside, that the invasion was going to take place. And that makes it worse, Brett. If you knew the invasion was going to take place and you didn't rush to get weapons in to defend themselves, you just got them a ride to get out, famously.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and that is like almost a month's heads up, according to the intel officials there in that book. And since then, we found out that they did have a lot of heads up. And if you look at the slow roll to get stuff over there, that's where a lot of the criticism comes from, that Ukraine, you know, lost a step or two, but yet was still able to hold Kyiv and to push Russia back.
Yeah, and just lastly on foreign policy, Netanyahu going in to Lebanon, having incredible amount of success, and now the president saying over the weekend he had no plans to talk to him. It looks like they will talk today. But, man, these guys are not on the same page, and Vice President Harris seems to have a lot of animus towards him. I think that's affecting policy, because in case she wins, he knows things are never going to be the same, and the prime minister is not going anywhere in Israel right now. His popularity is on the rise.
It is on the rise, and that's a big turn of fortunes. They have had a string of military successes, and, yeah, it's cold. It's icy between President Biden and also, it seems, Vice President Harris and Bibi Netanyahu. That question about is the prime minister an ally, obviously you can read between the lines in Vice President Harris's answer. I do think that, you know, because of the U.S.-Israel ties, that they'll have to deal with each other. But I don't think that the Israelis are telling the U.S. as much as they've told us before. And there are some moves that'll be surprises. And one of them may be the next strike on Iran in response.
Well, we know that's coming. I think even the G7 said they all agree there should be one. I want to bring you somewhere else, Brett. In CBS, this guy, Tony DeCoppo, I'd never met him. I have the morning show.
This,
yeah, I've never. But he had, I thought, a great exchange with this author, Taisi Coates, and he's out and he's talking about basically from the Palestinian point of view, and basically Israel doesn't belong where they are, and they basically are the problem. So he, I thought, took him on. Cut 36.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. Mm. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist.
Mm.
And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Mm. Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it?
Mm.
Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel in any condition has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world.
So he goes on, he goes back and forth, and it was an intellectual conversation. I thought, oh, that was interesting. Well, there's a massive fallout. They say that doesn't reach CBS standards in some sections. Then they have other people sticking up for him. He had a teary-eyed, I guess, addressing of the staff. What's your take on what we understand about this meltdown at CBS?
It just seems very strange. And it seems like executives stepping in. In an interview that arguably was just pushing back on another side, like we all do in questions, you know, devil's advocate, playing the other side, asking the other question. Jen Crawford stood up and said, the Supreme Court reporter pushed back. And obviously these audio tapes of this meeting came out, which made the story a little bit bigger. Howie did something last night on it. I think it's just really telling about the state of media and the sensitivity that this issue of Israel-Palestinians causes.
Right. I just thought, you know, doesn't that make it better for the book, for the author? The author wasn't defensive. It's made him defend his point of view. He's very calm. He didn't get emotional. So here is CBS's chief legal correspondent. I'm just going to play a little of this. Cut 41.
It sounds like we're calling out one of our anchors in a somewhat public setting on this call for failing to meet editorial standards for, I'm not even sure what. Like, I don't understand how Tony's interview or any of his comments that he's made with anchors fail to, you know, meet our editorial standards that obviously go back to the days of Murrow and you know, Cronkite.
And they basically tried to get a psychologist in there to address the staff. I've never seen such an overcompensation on an interview. I mean,
yeah.
Do you think it's the topic or the tone or the fact that he's black?
I don't know. The author came out and said that he was fine at the conversation. But, you know, they were going to bring in this DEI expert who then had his own issues and called Senator Tim Scott Uncle Tim in some writings and then had other things. So they canceled that guy and, you know, they had this meeting. I think it's very strange. And for CBS in the middle of all of this to be doing that is kind of weird. Now, on the plus side, I think Bill Whitaker did a nice job on his interview with at 60 Minutes and Vice President Harris. So they had pluses and minuses this week.
What's your take on the edit? I mean, they put out a promo and she's wrestling with this answer. And then they seem to clean up her answer for the final edit on the piece that aired.
Yeah. No, listen, I've not seen an answer within 30 seconds that was edited four times. And if you look at the digital, you know, they put stuff online, it's really a completely different answer. She looks a lot better, obviously, in the edited answer than she does in the what takes a meandering time. I understand editing for time, but four edits in a 30-second soundbite, it's really quite something.
Trump just, they forwarded me his Truth Social. He's outraged by it, but doesn't this back up his opinion that they're biased against him? I watched the Leslie Stahl interview. She was totally unfamiliar with the fact that the laptop, there might be a chance it's not real or that his campaign was spied on. She was clueless about that, or she was intentionally clueless about that. Why would he go back on there? And this edit to make her look better just backs up his move. They wouldn't be treated fairly. I don't think anybody thinks he's afraid of a hard interview, Brett.
Yeah, I agree. You know, he could do a couple more, I'm sure, but he's been out and about. The Leslie Stahl thing, she kept on calling it disinformation or it can't be verified. And obviously, you know, Scott Pelley, as he did that setup, didn't acknowledge any of that because it was verified.
So here's what Harris said about Biden stepping down, and see if you know what I picked up. They don't ask. Cut 15.
By President Biden stepping down and basically handing you a nomination, you didn't have to go through a primary process. You didn't have to fight off other contenders. That's not really the way our system was intended to work.
President Biden made a decision that I think history is going to show is rare among leaders, which was to put country before self. And I am proud to have earned the support of the vast majority of delegates and to have been elected the Democratic nominee. I am proud to have received the endorsement of leaders around this country from every background and walk of life.
So that's not really answering the question.
There's something missing from that Q&A, and that is, when did you know that his faculties were so diminished that he could not be president?
Yes.
You know, or that he could not be the nominee. When did you know, and how did you know it, and why didn't you say something? Or, you know, I don't know, some questioning down that road about all the meetings she had once a week at least with a president who clearly had diminished capabilities on the trail.
But don't you think there are networks out there, Brett, that will not admit to that? They will not. They will not say that. We don't know. They won't admit. They love that he left. That he left the race, but they won't say why.
Yeah, no, it's true. And look at the New York Times with this big piece about, you know, former President Trump's mental, you know, questions about his mental capacity and is he slipping? Yet there was no massive piece about Biden in that newspaper.
I know.
And so it's really. You know, listen, we always talk about this through the prism of what if it was the other way. But it is pretty stunning to day-to-day have more and more examples of that.
Yeah, it's hard to put the prism down. We're always picking up the prism. hey, Brett, you're going to have a long day, I know. And also your History Club book is out on paperback, right?
Yeah. This is the kids' book, and it's – really, it's done well. A lot of kids, 7 to 14 years old, and you sneak in a little history there. It's out on paperback and should be a fun read for folks.
Got it. Brett Baer, talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Okay.
We come back. Your calls, 1-866-408-7669.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everybody. So we're looking at this storm, but we're also looking at a media blitz by Kamala Harris. I'm talking about Colbert. I'm talking about Howard Stern. I'm talking about 60 Minutes. I'm talking about a podcast that comes out of nowhere. I'm just amazed about what she's doing. To me, there's only one reason why she's doing this. The only reason. Why would a risk-averse candidate avoid press conferences, any unscripted tough interview outside 60 Minutes? Now that makes one. The other interview that she might have been challenging Dana Bash on CBS, she did with her vice presidential nominee, and they couldn't land a glove on her because not one real question was really asked. Why would she do that? It has to be because the numbers they're showing, what they're seeing from their focus groups and their internals, is that she's trailing. That's the only thing I could say. And what they're doing is they're trying to make him unserious, unworthy, unhinged. The country comes to an end. That's what the theme is. If you watch the surrogates, as much as her, but even more the surrogates, that's what they're trying to say. They're not talking about economic. They're not talking about immigration. They're not even talking abortion as much as he is not worthy. They're scared he's going to win. Really scared he's going to win. And believe me, there's nothing that she did last night and through all these interviews, and including The View, forgot about The View, that's going to help her fortunes. Congressman Jody Arrington's here.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Goal number one of the strategic plan for FEMA is to instill equity as a foundation of emergency management.
It's a really important part of my vision when I came into the agency, and I'm happy to see how it's evolved through the development of our strategic plan. By creating this diverse workforce is incredibly important to better represent the communities that we're helping.
So I thought that was pretty unbelievable. Deanne Criswell, who's running FEMA right now, her number one strategic goal when she took the job in 2022 is to instill equity at the foundation of emergency management. Really? I want to make sure a bisexual Indian of Pakistani descent ends up coming to save me as opposed to somebody really qualified. I mean, that whole attitude is starting to reverse itself. But when you see her on the ground and late and defensive when people ask where they are, and when she was asked, where is FEMA? People can't find him. He said, just because you can't see us doesn't mean we're not there, which is insane. With me right now is Congressman Jody Arrington of Texas on the House Budget Committee. He's kind enough to be in studio. Congressman, what are your thoughts about the FEMA setup? Do you think that plays into what I think is some poor action in North Carolina these last weeks?
Well, I think there's a few things going on. Number one, there's tremendous incompetency at the top, and that trickles down throughout the government. Number two, there are these ideological social programs, DEI, ESG, that are distracting from the mission, in this case, of providing emergency relief to our citizens. But in Afghanistan debacle, you saw it there. You saw the lack of preparation and focus with the Secret Service and the disastrous and abject failure to protect President Trump. So it's pervasive now in the federal government, and it starts at the top. But lastly, we're spending, at least at this point, I understand, $1.6 billion in a FEMA fund to provide emergency services, food, shelter, et cetera, for people who broke the law, who are here in this country illegally. And we've only spent $45 million to help our fellow citizens in the disaster zone in the states that were affected by the recent hurricane. It's a shameful situation where this administration has prioritized taking care of their self-inflicted disaster of the border crisis versus our citizens and their effects, their impact from the natural disaster.
So what would you say? It's not something that involves Texas directly, but we're seeing Georgia get hit by Helene. You see parts of South Carolina get hit, but mostly North Carolina get hit. And now when it's brought up, you know, where have you been? Why were you at the beach when this hit? Why did you not call the Army in for a week? People say, well, that's disinformation. Everything's fine. Well, I've never heard a criticism being labeled disinformation. You might not like the criticism, but you can't just say that's disinformation.
Yeah, if you're
but
not.
They're all saying it.
Well, here's what's happening. Kamala Harris is spending all of her time trying to rebrand herself as a small government, low tax, progressive Democrat.
Who has a gun.
Who has a gun and believes in your right to speak, and et cetera. But think about this for a minute. As budget chairman, we've done the cost of the border crisis. $9,000 per illegal immigrant is what we're spending on those folks who have broken the law. And this administration, obviously complicit in their policies that have encouraged it. $9,000 per illegal immigrant. Kamala Harris is in Georgia saying, quote, if you need it, we'll cut you a $750 check. Meanwhile, this administration has given $2,300 per illegal immigrant for health care, $1,300 per illegal immigrant in welfare, mm-hmm. and the $9,000 total cost of taxpayer services to illegal immigrants is more than we spend on our most vulnerable Americans for Medicaid benefits.
Within FEMA, can you move money around? I mean, that's a big question. They say they're out of money. We had the Homeland Security Secretary say, I need a replenishment. And at the same time, they're giving money to that cause from FEMA. At the same time, there's an emergency need shortly for Milton and currently for Helene.
We've already authorized a drawdown of $20 billion. We did that in the CR before we broke for October. So they've got the money. That's the money's there. They're drawing down that money right now. It's no longer $20 billion. It's over $10 billion. We're not going to let the American people suffer without the resources to support them. But here's the point, Brian. I mean, we're now borrowing $6 billion a day. Okay, that's after $7 trillion in deficit spending,
right.
Another $5 trillion in additional interest on the debt, which is now $1 trillion because of the policies of this administration. And they have moved money all over the people's government, from housing to health care. Just recently, mm-hmm. CBO reported $16 billion in Medicaid for providing health care generally at the emergency room for people here illegally. They've moved money all around the people's government for the purpose of dealing with illegal immigrants and their priorities, but right. They haven't put the American people at the top of that list, and they're suffering from it as a result.
And they're not coming back and checking with Congress to do that. A couple other things. One I want to bring up, the fact is they say border crossings are down. And how much credit does Texas belong for that and get for that because of what they did on their own? You guys spending money out of your own state pockets, able to put up your own barrier, have to have your own essentially border patrol, do your own thing. And because of that, you were getting sued by this government until the last time. Border barriers floats over the Rio Grande to stop it. They're suing you because of that.
That's the insult to injury, if you will. People need to understand this. I think to get the first part, we have a commander in chief that's been, and the vice president and borders are Kamala Harris, have been derelict in their first and most important job to provide for the common defense and protect our borders and our people. They've abdicated that. Texas is not a state that's going to sit there and wring their hands. They're going to fill the gap and they're going to protect their citizens. But not only have they failed to enforce the laws and protect our citizens, they're obstructing Texas at every step of the way. Like you said, the buoy barriers, the barbed wire fencing, you name it. And our recent Senate Bill 4, which basically says if Texas finds out that you're here illegally, we will deport you immediately.
Right.
So all of this is tied up in the courts, and they've basically weaponized the Department of Interior, saying that the Mexican mussel is a critical habitat in the Rio Grande River. What about the critical lives of the American people that are suffering as a result? So, Brian, it's completely upside down.
So that Texas gang, the lethal Texas Venezuelan gang, was found in Texas, Tren de Aragua. The DPS picked up some of these gang members in Houston who followed a woman to through her garage, tied her up, and threatened to chop off her fingers if she didn't give them all the money in a safe. She had none. They ended up getting $75,000 and not chopping it off. But little by little, they catch up with almost all these guys. They arrested after a DPS special agent assigned in the Houston case was notified of a suspected member. Then they got some of the other guys. So this is happening all over the place with these illegal aliens in Chicago. Killed somebody, but they said you can go out on your own because you did it by mistake. We're seeing this over and over again. Here's Governor Greg Abbott yesterday, cut 34.
I think that interview is disqualifying. She has no answer to what's going on the border. She has 3.5 years, almost 4 years now in office as vice president and cannot articulate what needs to be done to secure the border. But on top of that, she was flat out lying to the American public because she talked about from day one they had solutions. To be clear, from day one, what they did was to gut all of the policies that President Trump put into place that secured the border far more secure than it's been in about 40 years. And ever since then, what Harris has done is refused to do anything to implement any type of border security.
So, and now she wants to come off tough, saying that we made a proposal when this administration first started. They had the House and Senate. Don't know where that went. It's all basically an amnesty program, and from what I could tell by the summary. Number two is there was a bipartisan deal that Lankford, Murphy, and Sinema put together. You should have signed off on that. It would have solved all the problems. And that's the issue. Not that she let it go for 3.5 years. Not that she never went to the border for 3.5 years. Not that she even was interested in this for 3.5 years. But now she wants to come out tough on it. What's the reality?
The reality is the last year of President Trump, he effectively stopped illegal immigrant migration about 1,000 a day. Now it's well over 10,000 a day. So it's out of control. And they've had no interest in enforcing the law. I think it's intentional. By the way, I think the border czar Kamala Harris initially blamed it on climate, and you're right, and so what we know is they've ceded control to terrorist drug cartels. As a Texan, I can tell you they've empowered and enriched these terrorist cartels who are abusing these folks, these vulnerable people who have been encouraged to come here because of the open border policies of this administration, and they've put in peril the citizens of my state and other states throughout the country. And they've basically trafficked these people the last mile with your tax dollars. That FEMA money that we talked about earlier, that money goes to transporting illegals to a town and neighborhood near you. And they didn't vet these people. They don't know their backgrounds. What they at least admitted recently was over 500,000 of those that they released into our neighborhoods were convicted felons, some who had been convicted of murder, of rape, and other violent crimes. So we're being deluged with drugs and crimes and criminal elements, and it's destroying our quality of life.
Let's shift to 2024, and it is Kamala Harris went from doing no interviews to doing 4 in 1 in 2 days. You had 60 Minutes, you got The View, you got Colbert, you have Howard Stern. To me, that's the act of a candidate that's losing. the only time you do something like that. You put someone who's not sure of herself in unscripted situations and put them in unscripted situations. What do you see?
I see all hat and no cattle. I see an incompetent executive, to put it lightly and professionally. She has no business being the CEO of the most powerful and greatest country in the world. I see someone who was the most radical senator. I see somebody who is part of the radical fringe left that has created the problems.
So she's changed.
Yeah, she's going to try to make that appeal, and probably it's best that she doesn't do a lot of interviews because it's going to reveal her real value system, which is to radically transform this country, which is what they tried to do the last 4 years, and a pretty good job of it, by the way. But that's what I see. I see the same strategy they deployed when President Biden was running as a candidate. Keep him in the basement. Keep him away. Right. Don't let anybody see the fact that he was incapacitated.
But when did he come out of the basement? When he looked like he had to fight for the nomination before they took it away
from
him.
That's true.
He went out and did a press conference. He did three or four network interviews, lost his temper, had as much downside as upside, did a bunch of rallies.
That's a good point.
He said, I'm not going anywhere. The God Almighty's got to come down. That's the only person that could get me out of this race. So now, why did she stay away? Well, she thought it was in her best interest. Why is she not getting away? Why is she not? What changed? Something in her internal said, nobody knows you, and it's not okay anymore.
Well, it's a great point. I take that as a positive sign that the American people have better judgment than what they think they have, and they don't want any more of this inflation, border crisis, feckless foreign policy, weak posture on the world, no respect, or at least a lack of respect, not only by our enemies, but also our allies. Right. So I think it's a good sign. And listen, the more despair she has to come out and do these interviews, the more people will see she is woefully underqualified for this job.
So that's true. And, you know, we were talking before, nobody could say Bill Clinton wasn't talented. Nobody could say Barack Obama wasn't talented. You might disagree with policies. You go, okay, that's a good candidate. George W. Bush was very personable, knew his stuff, surrounded himself with great people. He didn't have the eloquence of Clinton, but he had charm. And there was,
sure.
I'm looking at her. I am desperate to see any substance. I think it's doing. I don't think we should ever talk about if someone's smart or dumb. That's not a matter.
Yep.
How sure they are the topics. She's sure in legal stuff. That's her area. But you can't talk about domestic policy, tax policy, foreign policy, anything. It looks all memorized. Congressman, you know a lot of natural politicians. You know a lot of people who are very smart. They just don't like the political part of it. Where does she fit in?
I don't think she's even smooth and slick, which is not impressive anyway, because you can be smooth and slick and have all the wrong policies or be deceptive about what you really want to do when you're sort of campaigning to do one thing. I think my concern with her is just a track record. Let's just look at the two things that she was specifically assigned to do on behalf of the Biden-Harris administration. She was supposed to be the border czar, and it's been an unmitigated and unprecedented failure and self-inflicted failure on account of her incompetence.
Didn't even try.
And just the more she talked, the worse it got. And then there was the deception of the border is secure. Now all of a sudden it's not secure. And it was a matter of a bipartisan bill in Congress.
Yeah.
It would do nothing. It would just be window dressing, to put it mildly. And we could go through that bill. The second assignment she had that was very specific was to deploy 40 plus $40+ billion in broadband infrastructure to close the digital divide in rural areas like West Texas and the people I represent. Not one person is on the internet. Not one person has access to the internet as a result of her being in charge of deploying broadband technology. Right. So I just take those two, forget the policies, the radical policies for a minute, and just look at those two assignments and the abject failure.
So lastly, real quick, Ted Cruz in trouble? What do you think? It's a 2 or 3 point race?
It's going to be a close race. It was when he ran against Beto O'Rourke, and I think he'll do better than the Beto race. But no, Texans are going to send Ted Cruz back up here to fight for their freedom and to fight alongside President Trump.
Congressman Jody Arrington, thanks so much. Great to see you
in person. Thank you, Brian.
All right, and stay out of trouble in New York.
God bless.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. We'll squeeze in some calls. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You know, when you first became the nominee and named Tim Walz as your vice president nominee, people were calling it the vibe election. Everybody, all the vibes were all good. But elections, I think, are won on vibes because one of the old saws is they just want somebody they can have a beer with.
Uh-huh.
So would you like to have a beer with me so I can tell people what that's like? Okay. This was... Now, we asked ahead of time, because I can't just be given a drink to the Vice President of the United States without asking. You asked for Miller High Life. You asked for Miller High Life. I'm just curious.
Okay, the last time I had beer was at a baseball game with Doug. So.
Okay, so cheers.
Okay,
there you
cheers.
Go. There you go. Ooh. That
yep.
tastes like the beautiful city of Milwaukee,
the
Wisconsin.
Champagne and beers.
There you go.
Right. And is that the image that you want? And maybe you do. Maybe you think it's no big deal. While you have Milton bearing down on Florida. I mean, is that the image that you want? As North Carolina says, you know, we can't find a lot of people and we need helicopters to get in. And you were 10 days late when bringing in the Army and the Army says they were ready. Do you still have your handlers who say, do The View, do Howard Stern and end up on Stephen Colbert at night having a beer? I think there's a reason. Joe Biden, you know what he did? He was supposed to go to Germany and Angola. An inconsequential, not an emergency trip, nothing to do with Ukraine or Israel. So he canceled it. Said, I can't do it. She didn't cancel anything. So don't get mad at DeSantis for not calling you back because you're not in the chain of command and say it's politics. And at the same time, you're going on all these shows as if you don't own a windbreaker, don't care about the weather, don't care about the hurricane. Can't have it both ways, I don't think. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. I want to see you on. I want to see you in Peekskill, New York, home of Governor George Pataki.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Don't miss a minute of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have all the breaking news. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. I mean, what a mess Manhattan is. I mean, do you've been tracking this? One of the most powerful positions, mayor positions in the world. I mean, as you could just say, that if you're mayor of New York, a lot of times you're really more powerful than the governor. If you're mayor of New York. And you have a situation where this mayor is losing a different person every day close to him, and they're all in trouble. And then he is in trouble. He's been indicted. They're going to expand the charges. So he's totally unable to do anything. And in the back of my mind, I just say to myself, whatever you think of Mayor Adams, the guy before is a lot worse. What is it about him that has everyone looking at everything he's done and everyone around him and putting them all in jail? Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Hung Cao. He's a Virginia GOP Senate nominee. He's a Vietnamese immigrant who spent 25 years in the Navy, and people that know him say he is absolutely an elite warfighter. He had a fantastic debate. He's going to be joining us, too. We have Stephen Moore standing by. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
No, think about it. He thinks Vladimir Putin is his friend. What about the American people? They should be your first friend.
But if Donald Trump, even if it's true, look, is there something wrong with speaking to world leaders?
And that's true. This is one of the revelations in Bob Woodward's book, New Tell All, as revelations creating quite an uproar from Vladimir Putin to Trump to Biden to Obama. If true, a lot of nerves will be rubbed raw.
Number two.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Really? Okay. Most of the decision has had impact. The Harris media blitz continues. And like her boss, Biden, who attempted to rally his base when he got in political trouble, she's creating problems with her lack of answers and inability to display knowledge and handle issues. Meanwhile, Trump's battleground blitz continues. He's going to be two stops in Pennsylvania today.
Number one.
How confident are you that FEMA will have what it needs to take care of impacted Americans moving forward?
Very confident. We have demonstrated that in response to Hurricane Helene with an extraordinary breadth of resources.
Okay, I don't believe a word of it, but HHS Secretary Mayorkas suddenly has money for Milton, a massive hurricane expected to slam the west coast of Florida in the next few hours. Today, and this is just 2 weeks ago when Helene did the same, and some areas of Florida really got hit hard, and that debris is going to be weaponized with this new wind coming in from Milton. How has the federal and state government responded, and could this be an October surprise if people can't get to the polls because their life's in tatters and not thinking about voting? And a lot of these guys, these areas are Republican areas. With me right now is Stephen Moore, economist and author. He's co-authored The Trump Economic Miracle and The Plan to Unleash Prosperity Again. Stephen, welcome back.
Hey, Brian. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me. By the way, the new book is just out. It just came out this week. The title of that new book, are you ready for this, Brian? The Trump Economic Miracle. And by the way, Brian, can you guess who came up with that title?
Trump?
Yeah, he did. Arthur Laffer and I had a meeting with him about 6 weeks ago. We told him we had written the book about, you know, what the book really does is contrast the economic performance of Trump versus Biden/Harris. And not to ruin the ending, but on virtually every single economic measurement, Brian, Trump's performance was far superior to anything that's happened under Biden and Harris. But anyway, so we showed Trump all the charts and stuff like that, showing how much better he did on the economy than Biden. And he said, what are you going to call this book? And we said, well, we were thinking about calling it Trumponomics 2.0 because we'd written a book called Trumponomics about 7 years ago. He said, no, I don't like that title. Call it The Trump Economic Miracle. That's how it came about. But it's a really important – I want people to get it, especially for people who are undecided at this point, because if you just look at the evidence that we present in that book, and by the way, it's one of those books you could read it in two or three nights. It's a very short read, but it really lays out the case that Trump, and in virtually every single area, whether it's small business conditions, whether it was inflation, whether it's the price of food and gas, whether it was what's happened to real incomes for middle-class families, it's been a disaster under Biden and under Trump. Everything went really well. So that's why I think it's going to come down to who do you trust more on the economy? I really do, Brian. And I think if that's the question, we all know the answer.
So the U.S. budget deficit topped $1.8 trillion in the latest fiscal year. These are the numbers that just came in.
Unbelievable.
The new data comes as Trump and Harris have both proposed new tax and spending plans. They're estimated to add trillions of dollars, they say, to the deficit over the next decade. The government collected $4.92 trillion in revenue and spent $6.75, putting the deficit at $1.83.
And
just to inform, I know you know this, but the previous year was $1.7. The deficit was higher. The largest entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, they cost 6% more than they did in 2023 and going up.
So do you know what the second biggest expenditure item is today, Brian, in the entire federal budget?
Is it paying off the interest?
Yep, paying off the interest. And we're paying $1 trillion of taxes now just to pay for the interest on this enormous debt. I mean, I fell off my chair laughing yesterday when this left-wing group called the Committee for a Responsible Budget said that Trump would be worse on the deficit than Harris would. When Harris is proposing trillions and trillions of dollars of new spending, I mean, everything's going to be free under Kamala. Free home care, free child care, free – you don't have to pay your student loans back. We're going to give you a free, college is going to be free. Everything's going to be free. And when she was asked that question on 60 Minutes, how are you going to pay for that? That interview was, 5 days ago. We still don't have an answer.
Yeah, they say right now, just to your numbers, the U.S. spent $950 billion on interest, up 34% than private year. And that is linked to the prime rate, right?
Say that again.
Is that linked to the interest rate in the country right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, interest rates have gone through the roof under – there's two reasons we have a high interest payments. One is because we're borrowing so much, and the second reason is because we're borrowing at a higher interest rate. Remember how low interest rates were when Trump was president? I'll give you an example. The mortgage interest rate when Trump left office was 3%. Now around the country it's 6.5%. So everything – you know, Kamala said, oh, I'm going to give everybody $25,000 for the down payment on their home. The average mortgage payment today is almost twice as high as it was when Trump was president.
And they did it to tame inflation economists say was driven by the massive spending and the rescue package that we didn't need, that we just had a spending plan out of COVID in December. In comes Biden, says, I don't want to let a crisis go to waste, and jabs a huge agenda-driven rescue package.
That's precisely right. And so we spent $5 trillion above. And by the way, you know, we were borrowing too much even under Trump. And then Biden comes in and spends another $5 trillion and drove the deficit to all-time high. And I have to say, you played that clip from, I forget, was that on The View, where Kamala said, I wouldn't have done anything differently. I mean, to me, that's game, set, and match. Really. I mean, in other words, we're going to get 4 more years of this? Really? I think they're going to bankrupt our country.
It doesn't surprise me, because she has not really separated herself from Joe Biden. So it looks like Joe Biden's mad already. She doesn't talk more about everything they allegedly did together. So he seems to be passively aggressive going after her or the team that kind of left him. Here's what she said about Medicare and this new program she has to cover in-home health care. Right. Cut 12.
What I am proposing is that basically what we will do is allow Medicare to cover in-home health care.
Oh. Fine.
Right. So, and because we're talking about these kinds of things where it's just about helping an aging parent or person, prepare a meal, put their sweater on.
Yes.
And it's about dignity for that individual, plus for the family to send them to a residential care facility to hire somebody is so expensive. Oh,
yeah. So your thoughts?
So, I mean, this is amazing. Do you know, the Wall Street Journal reported that the average cost for home health care can be, over $500,000 a year. So where is the money going to come from? I mean, one of my heroes was Ronald Reagan, and he used to say something, Brian, that I hope every voter keeps in mind, which is, remember, he used to say, a government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you've got. And if they were to, she's proposed a $5 trillion tax increase, the biggest tax increase in the history of the United States. I lived through, candidates like Michael Dukakis and Walter Mondale and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. I would say that she is far, far to the left. She's the most anti-business candidate the Democrats have ever come up with.
Yeah. I actually think this. Bernie Sanders, exactly where he stands. You think the math doesn't work, and you and I don't agree with what he believes in, but I believe that he does. I don't know what she believes. I think there's a bunch of – for example, taxing unrealized gains, whether it's a 401k or whether it's at IPO, or if you had a good year and your stock increased in value, you're paying taxes on it. If you don't have that money, you're going to have to sell it.
Yep.
So for her, she doesn't come up. Don't tell me that she came up with that. Somebody had to have told her that.
Well, I don't know where this idea came from. It is crazy. You're right. We'd literally have people having to sell the family farm to pay the taxes on the appreciation of the farm value. It would kill small business and family-owned businesses. And also, by the way, I bet most of the people listening to your show, if not virtually all of them, have like a 401k plan or a retirement plan where the money is invested in the stock market. It's not just rich people who own stock. All of us own stock in our companies. And you put in place higher capital gains tax, the higher corporate tax, the tax on, as you said, tax unrealized capital gains. And don't forget,
Under her plan, she would double the hated, remember, the death tax. We want to get rid of it. She wants to double it. When you add all those taxes together, the tax on investment would be so high, it would kill the stock market. You're talking about huge reductions in the value of your portfolios, and that's people's wealth.
So she said one of the things when she was asked by 60 Minutes, where's this money coming from? The wealthy have to pay their fair share. Well, what is their fair share? So Dave Portnoy, who's wealthy, the creator of Barstool, wrote this. Real talk. Am I getting screwed on taxes? I pay 50% of everything. Am I screwing you on taxes? I pay 50% of everything I make to the government. Is Kamala saying the teachers, nurses, and firefighters pay over 50%? I've asked my accountants for this super wealthy tax break. They can't seem to find it. How many people that you know say the same thing? Not only are you paying the taxes, you're being vilified by not paying enough while you're working, in his case, and in my case, 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week. The risk he took, handing out flyers for years that say Barstool on it while people just jamming it to people's hands as they went to work in Boston. Now he ends up a super wealthy guy and he's been told he's the problem. How many people listening to me like that feel the same way, but they don't say anything?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the same boat. You know, I'm not rich. I'm upper middle income. You know, when I come home from work, my wife always reminds me, you know, we are well over half of your paycheck, Steve, is going to the government now. And I'm not, you know, I'm not in the top 1%. I'm not maybe close to, I'd like to be in the top 10%. But the point is, the top people in that top 1% category, she says, aren't paying any taxes. Do you know, Brian, they pay almost half of the income tax?
Yes. I mean, it's just so, and they sit there.
What the hell is she talking about? 1%, one out of 100 Americans pay half of the income tax, and she says they're not paying enough.
Now, I got to ask you this, because you had a lot to do with the tax reform passed in 2018.
Yep.
When they say he passed tax reform for billionaires, he just happens to be rich and did tax reform. That's it. I heard the biggest people that got the biggest break were the middle class at 16%, correct?
Yeah, we lowered the income. The average American saved about $2,200 a year on their taxes. Kamala Harris would repeal the entire Trump tax cut, which means she's going to – the first thing she will do out of the gate is raise taxes for already overly stressed financially families by $2,200. The share of taxes paid by the rich – ready for this, Brian – went up after the Trump tax cut, not down. They went up.
It's crazy. And by the way, corporate tax – it's not that corporate CEOs are going to get to take more money home. Would you describe why corporate tax works for Americans?
Well, the corporate tax is a tax on the profits that a business makes. We want our businesses to be profitable. As I just said, who owns American corporations? We all do. Almost everybody listening to the show owns a piece of the rock. And so what you do when you raise the corporate tax is you chase businesses and factories out of the United States. And they go to Ireland, or they go to the Bahamas, or they go to the Bermuda, or they go to China. We want our companies here. We brought thousands of companies back to the United States under Trump because we lowered our tax rate.
From 35 to 21.
Yep, you got it.
Right. Thanks so much. Steve, congratulations on the book. It's called The Trump Economic Miracle and the Plan to Unleash Prosperity Again. The truth about the dollars and cents. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Brian.
1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Which foreign country do you consider to be our greatest adversary?
I think there's an obvious one in mind, which is Iran. Iran has American blood on their hands, okay? This attack on Israel, 200 ballistic missiles, what we need to do to ensure that Iran never achieves the ability to be a nuclear power, that is one of my highest priorities.
So if you have proof that Iran is building a nuclear weapon, would you take military action?
I'm not going to talk about hypotheticals at this moment.
Well, they're about to get hit, no doubt about it. I don't mind that answer. China, Russia, just like when Mitt Romney came out and said Russia is our number one geopolitical foe, and then Barack Obama said the 1980s called and they want their foreign policy back. How bad did that age for Barack Obama? Terrible. Nobody calls him on it. You know, he's out of the picture now, and so is Mitt Romney. But for her, I don't mind that answer. But if you mind, if that is in fact true, and they've been our enemy since 1979, and she's in fact right, why would we not play a dominant role in the retribution of Iran for having a massive missile attack twice over the last 6 months? Brian, listen to listening on WHLL over in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me on, especially after I left my radio on last time. I apologize.
No problem. Real quick.
You had on about the taxes. You know, I know it's close to the election, but a simple billboard reminding everybody have a great day at work, working half your day paying the government taxes. You know,
and then be told it's not enough, Brian. Then be told it's not enough and you're hoarding it.
Right? They're taking it. And then what's that cost of all the illegals that they're letting in, like in the Springfield that they're flying in?
Right. And then we got to put them in schools. We got to get a French Creole interpreter and put that into classrooms and then provide housing, room and board. It's a ton. And no one asked us.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You know, the economy is hitting us all the same way. Ask yourself this question. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? The answer across the board is no. The only people better off today than they were 4 years ago are illegal aliens, criminals, and senators like Senator Tim Kaine.
That is Hung Cao. He is a Virginia GOP Senate candidate who did exceedingly well at this debate, which is not easy to do with an experienced politician like Tim Kaine, who was on Hillary Clinton's running mate, you may remember. Cao is a Vietnamese immigrant who spent 25 years in the Navy, including service in combat zones around the world, and wasn't done giving up his time and his life for the country. Now he wants to serve as a senator. A new poll from Christopher Newport University Watson Center has it 55, has a 20-point lead for Kaine, but we don't really have the impact of that debate next. Hung Cao, welcome back.
Brian, thank you so much for having me.
All right.
You know, the poll is all screwed up. I'm telling you right now that it's all the other polls have me a lot closer. That one's just way out far left. And you see this across the country, too. Everybody from Sam Brown in Nevada and Kerry Lake, they're all way below Trump. And I'm telling you right now, I'll buy everybody on your show a dinner at, Ruth's Chris Steakhouse or something like that if they can find me somebody that's going to vote for Donald Trump and in the same breath vote for someone crazy like Tim Kaine.
I know. Having him at the top of the ticket certainly going to affect things. For a while, they say, well, Trump's so adverse. In 2016, they used to say, Trump is so different as a Republican, these senators have to overcome, and the congressmen and women have to overcome this Trump, the Trump popularity. Now they realize they run with it. You did really well in that debate. You spoke from the heart. You know the issues. You fought for the country, and you love the country. You also know about the hottest issues personally, and that's immigration. Before we get into some more moments of that debate, Hung, can you tell me your immigrant story?
Yes. So I came to Vietnam from Vietnam in 1975. My father was marked for death or going to be sent to a re-education camp because he was a high-ranking government official. And so we fled over here and we came to the United States, and this country gave us everything. It gave us hope. It gave us education. It gave us opportunity. And I wanted to pay back everything that this country gave me with 25 years of service in Navy Special Operations and with combat in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia.
So you were here before you were a citizen?
Yes, absolutely. But you know what? We waited in line for 7 years to get that citizenship. We waited patiently, and then we paid back this country. And the last thing that hung over my father's bed was his naturalization certificate when he passed away 2 years ago.
How'd this country treat you when your family got here?
I mean, there's always, hardships and people like, oh, you guys come over here and, you take all the jobs. But the thing is, we just wanted to pay back. We wanted to work our tails off. We didn't want any handouts. You know, my parents were too proud to go on food stamps, and so my dad was working his tail off. And, in fact, we ended up having to move to Africa for 7 years because that's the only work he can find with a PhD in agriculture. So we lived in sub-Saharan Africa where I saw real, true hardships. You know, you have to let the water run for a long time for it to turn from dark brown to somewhat light, and you still have to filter it, boil it, and put iodine just to drink it.
So you're an American, so you're an American citizen, you're on your path, and yet you had to leave the country in order to get work. And with those type of degrees, you would think this country would have an endless opportunity. But do you think there was some resistance from the Vietnam War too, a reluctance after the Vietnam War?
There was a little bit. But the thing is, once they saw us roll up our sleeves and work our tail off, you know, next year is going to be the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And I'll be the first Vietnamese-American U.S. senator who will be inaugurated on that year. But I want to be able to turn to all the Vietnam vets out there and say, thank you. I hope that my service pays back for your sacrifice in Vietnam all those years, because they never got the recognition they deserved.
Fall of Saigon was an embarrassment for this country, leaving off the top of the embassy with just one chopper, leaving a lot of people behind. You think Afghanistan was worse?
Oh, yes, absolutely worse, because we never learned from our own mistakes. Right. And the same person that did that, remember that Joe Biden, his first vote in U.S. Senate was to stop all funding to South Vietnam. He said, I don't feel that we need to save 1 or 100,000 won Vietnamese. It's not our obligation. And look what he did to Afghanistan. And Kamala Harris now is saying, you know, she wouldn't do anything differently. Really? I mean, there's 11 Marines, one soldier, one sailor who's not breathing right now, who will never grow old, who will never get to hold their loved ones again, who will never see their kids, you know, grow up and get married because of that decision. You're saying that you're not going to do anything differently?
Talking to Hung Cao here, he's a GOP Senate nominee. He's taking on Tim Kaine. So I'm going to contrast your story with what happened in Afghanistan. There were some people there that helped us out. We tried to get out, but the vetting was terrible. We keep hearing that over and over again, more evidence. Yesterday we found out, Monday there was an arrest. An Afghan national in Oklahoma arrested for plotting an Election Day terrorist attack here in the U.S. We learned that the suspect entered the country in September 2021 as a, quote, special immigrant visa with no vetting after the U.S. pulled out. His name is Nasir Ahmed Talawidi, and he was obtained firearms, ammunition to conduct a violent attack on Election Day. So this one story is yours. Vietnam War didn't go like we wanted or the South Vietnamese preferred, obviously. And then you come over here and you say, I'm going to make a life myself in America. And this guy comes over here at 27 years old, sees the opportunity, sees what this country has given him, and says, I would like to destroy it.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you're not grateful for what this country is providing them. The country gave them an opportunity to really practice whatever you want, religion or your, you know, whatever you want to do. This country allows you to do it. And you want to choose to destroy us? And that's the problem. They let in also all these military-age males from the southern border. We found out now there's 13,000 convicted murderers and 16,000 convicted rapists that came across under Joe Biden's watch. And that's wrong. I mean, and not only that, I mean, don't forget – well, actually, I don't know people know this, but in December, a Chinese drone was flying off of a Chinese ship off the coast of Virginia and onto Langley Air Force Base and collected a lot of data, and we weren't allowed to protect our base there. We shut down F-22 flights for 8 days, and Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and Tim Kaine, you know, won't do anything about it.
So wait, a drone landed on our shores.
No, it's flying over Langley Air Force. Yeah, the only base in the United States that has F-22 Raptors in December. We had the ability to jam it. My company – you know, because I still work, had the ability to go down there with our technology and take down this drone.
I didn't hear anything of this.
Because they're hiding it. So, I mean, Brian, they're hiding a lot of things. They're hiding a lot of murders that are happening in our country from illegal aliens. They're hiding the fact that there's a Chinese national who crashed a drone into a tree. And when the police came to see him, he goes, oh, let me go home and get a ladder. And he never came back. When they downloaded the drone, when they got the drone off the download, there's a picture of every ship in Norfolk Harbor. And they found that guy on a plane 2 days later trying to leave the country. These are things that are not being reported. A lot of you know, two Jordanians try to ram the base at Quantico Marine Corps base. I mean, these are
and they're
things
out. By the way, they got out, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
They're
absolutely
here still.
And so Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and Tim Kaine are directly responsible. If something happens right. to this country, I will hold them accountable.
I know you will. In fact, that came up at your debate. Listen.
Can't come here and expect the American dream if you're not willing to obey the American laws and embrace the American culture. That's what I did. There's violence and unrest now. Look at Aurora, Colorado. Look at all the other places in the world where MS-13 gangs are come across. Fentanyl. It's already happening. It's already happening in our country. Deport anybody that's committing crimes right now.
Yeah, I mean, there was a murder in Chicago. This guy's guilty. He's captured. Kim Fox, let him out. So, well, it was an accident. It's an accident to kill somebody? You throw them out. They're done.
No, you're absolutely right. So, Melody Waldecker is a grandmother up in Sterling that was killed by an illegal alien who was a carjacker. Lauren Nicole Leonard is a young student down in Chesapeake who was killed by an illegal alien. She's a student at Old Dominion University. A 12-year-old girl was abducted on the way to school by an illegal alien, and, you know, thank goodness they were able to find and rescue her. And then very recently, in my own county, in Loudoun County, this kid was kicked out of school for having a gun. They brought him back in school under the guise of another reason, and he's all tatted up. He's an MS-13 gang member. And what do you think he's going to do in our high schools to our children? At some point, we have to prioritize Americans first.
Absolutely. And you brought up this about recruitment. Listen.
When you're using a drag queen to recruit for the Navy, that's not the people we want. What we need is alpha males and alpha females who are going to rip out their own guts, eat them, and ask for seconds. Those are young men and women that are going to win wars.
Please, audience.
Audience love you. The moderator didn't. And that made a lot of news. I thought Tim Kaine was just kept staring at you, didn't know where that came from, but couldn't touch your credibility.
No, exactly. The guy has never worn the cloth of a nation. He has no idea how to defend this country. And it's not about DEI issues. It's about putting men and women who are willing to fight to the death for this country. That's what I was trying to say. Of course, the left tried to say I went on some weird cannibalistic rant. I'm like, no, you guys have never been punched in the face ever in your lives. You have no idea how to get in a fight, and you don't know how to win a fight.
So I want to bring you to right now what you think an appropriate response should be as Netanyahu gets an offer from Hezbollah for a ceasefire. And people say, and evidently their defense minister turned down an opportunity to come and speak to our Secretary of Defense, Austin, about some type of Iran retribution. Hung Cao, what would be the appropriate response to a ceasefire offer in Lebanon? And what would your answer be to 180 rockets being sent from Iran if you were Netanyahu?
Well, no, they need to destroy for me to talk about any kind of ceasefire, destroy all those rockets right here, right now. I mean, Iran has been emboldened because of the Biden administration, because of Kamala Harris, and also, you know, people in the Senate Armed Services Committee like Tim Kaine, right? They allowed for Iran to get all this money now because they lifted up all the sanctions. They're emboldened, and they have all the money in the world to do what they want. They don't even try to hide behind their proxies, the Houthis, Hezbollah, and Hamas anymore, because they're launching 300 missiles and drones at Israel. So the only defense Israel has right now is to destroy all these weapons that are pointed right at them.
So, and how do you feel about attacking their nuclear facilities? Some say Israel just does not have the firepower to do serious damage to their nuclear program.
I don't know if you remember a few years ago, all those nuclear scientists magically died.
Yes.
So
by machine gun.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that Israel can do a lot of things. It doesn't mean that we're going to blow up a nuclear reactor or something like that. People say that and it's just ridiculous. I mean, look, in Fukushima, the entire reactor went down when the storm took out the diesel generators. And that pumps in the water. So there's a lot of things you can do kinetically or non-kinetically that won't cause, you know, basically a major disaster. People just think, oh, my gosh, they're going to cause radiation all over. No, there's many ways for you to disable, reactors and everything else right. without causing a national emergency.
Hung Cao, I tell you, I was talking to David Bellavia, as you know, a Medal of Honor recipient. And he says what Netanyahu is showing America is how to win, not how to fight. We know that. but how to win. So let them win. How do you feel about that analogy?
No, you're absolutely right. We don't have the stomach right now with all these politicians to win wars. I mean, you saw that in Afghanistan. You saw that in Iraq. I mean, the same people that did that are now trying to dictate to Israel what they should or shouldn't do. Like, no, just sit back and just watch. Watch and learn, because, you know, you don't have any idea how to fight a war. These guys, they don't go in and they don't massacre everybody. They just go in and they take out the strategic sites that will cripple the enemy and force them to the negotiation table. They know how to defend themselves. They've never asked for American boot on the ground. They've never asked for anything except for support. And Joe Biden and Tim Kaine even signed a letter that says he's going to hold back weapons that keep Israel from being able to strike back.
Hung Cao, if people want to support your candidacy in this sprint to November 5th, where do they go?
Please go to hungforva.com. I'm telling you right now that this is a race that is going to surprise everybody. We're only a few points behind Tim Kaine. Don't believe all those other crazy polls, because they're trying to discourage voters and they're trying to discourage donors. But we have a very strong chance right now to win Virginia and flip this seat, and as well as get the presidency back.
Well, I'll put it this way. You'd be a huge asset in the Senate, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, care about this country, extremely bright, successful, it's great that you still want to give back. Hung Cao, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Back in a moment.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
There is a problem. There is a fundamental breaking of our core cellular biology that is caused by our diet and the world we're living in, the modern world we're living in today, that is crushing the very way that the human body and our human cells can transmit food energy to life energy, to cellular energy.
So that's Casey Means. I'm with Joe Rogan talking about one of the hottest issues in America, what we're eating. You know, people just say, well, you eat like crap and you're eating this food and that's where you got fat. Then it turns out you think you're eating good, but it turns out the Frankenstein foods, the processed foods, oh, it's killing us and helping Big Pharma. It makes me wonder if in More to Know, this is the same thing going down to another celebrity, Eva Menendez. Mendez, I should say. She grew up on cereal. She said, I loved it, but I will not eat it anymore, in Kellogg's anymore, after I found out that so many of the ingredients they use here in the U.S. are banned in other countries. Why? Because they're harmful for children. Special thanks to the Food Babe for helping bring this to light and demand that Kellogg remove these harmful artificial flavors. This is what RFK is talking about, right?
It's true, and it's also about revamping the FDA more, because if you look at our food labels compared to countries around the world, we are much more lenient in what they can put in our food.
All right, let's talk about The Office. Jenna Fischer, an Office star, reveals she has breast cancer. She's the actress best known for being Pam Beasley in the popular show The Office. Says it's stage one. She said this on Instagram. My tumor is small. It could not be felt on an exam. If I had waited 6 months longer, things would have been much worse. It could have spread. A lesson learned. I always wondered, did she do anything after? Do you know?
I think she did some smaller things, but I feel like she's always Pam.
Right.
She's
just always Eric, Pam. Do you watch The Office?
I did, yes.
Right. So do you know if Pam Fisher did anything else?
I do not know.
Right. Do you know that they told her, do not be too good looking? Like, tone it down. You're supposed to look like an office. They don't want anyone glamorous walking in.
I mean, but I thought she also portrayed, like, the girl next door perfectly, right? Because her character wouldn't have been, like, an overly done-up person. Then she wouldn't have been so likable.
Next, a young Chiefs fan's defamation lawsuit against Deadspin to move forward. I didn't know Deadspin was still around. Delaware Judge ruled on Monday that the Armitage family's lawsuit against Deadspin for accusing her son of wearing blackface at a Chiefs game last year can proceed. Remember, Karen Phillips wrote an article using an image of a 9-year-old Holden Armenta sporting black and red Kansas City Chiefs face paint, but showing only the black half of the face. Phillips accused Holden of finding a way to hate black people and the Native Americans at the same time. It's a kid. So dumb, so stupid. So they're suing, and this is going forward. This kid's going to win.
I mean, he should. It was such a ridiculous piece when they wrote it at the time. They're at the Chiefs game. Those are the colors. Like, you're putting only half his face up. It was just so, I mean, insincere, right. Being kind.
I know. He will lose. By the way, quick note, October 20th, Peekskill, New York, 7 o'clock starting. It's a Sunday. I want to see everybody there for History, Liberty, and Laughs live on stage. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country and around the world. It's our privilege to have in studio the former Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, who happens to be a Soviet expert, turned into a Russia expert, Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State for the 66th Secretary of State. Martha McCallum's coming up in 15, 20 minutes, who you also like, right? Yeah, absolutely. Who doesn't? It's great to see you.
Great to see you too, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and by the way, we're not ignoring Milton. It's going to hit land in a few hours. Let's just put it on hold because there's another different type of storm happening in the Middle East. We were just talked about a lot of things off camera. So much has happened since we talked to you. Since I didn't think the October 7th attacks were possible. Obviously, the Israelis didn't either. But 1 year later, do you think Hamas accomplished their goal to make them look vulnerable and isolate Israel around the world?
Well, Hamas, I think, first wanted to kill as many Jews as they could. And then they wanted to have Israel, quote, overreact and isolate Israel. The Israelis are very tough. And yes, you're getting calls for ceasefires and so forth and so on. But the Israelis are going to do what they have to do to make themselves secure again. They've weakened Hamas significantly. What they're doing to Hezbollah is unbelievable. And I think what you're starting to see is that the Israelis are tired of it. They're going to go after these proxies, and they're going to show that they can make Israel secure, and they're going to reestablish deterrence, which is what failed on October 7th.
So if, when you look at the Philadelphia border between Egypt and Gaza, the Egyptians had to know those tunnels were there. I mean, they were moving tractors in and out of there. So there's a now there's I don't know how much they trust each other to begin with, but there was a peace agreement at least. So now they can't trust it. So they need a presence on that border. Others who live there say, well, no, we don't really need a presence. We just keep our eye on it. Madam Secretary, do you agree that you can no longer keep your eye off that border because that's how they supplied?
Well, just to be clear, Brian, nobody kept their eye off that border. We were trying to work with the Egyptians to close those tunnels back in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. The last thing that I did was sign an MOU with Tzipi Livni just before I got out of the State Department.
What's an MOU?
A Memorandum of Understanding.
Okay.
Just before I left to try to work with the Egyptians to close those tunnels. So this has been going on for a long time. Hezbollah got a lot of support. Unfortunately, some of it came from the Israelis looking the other way while they got money to rearm from the Qataris, maybe not even looking the other way. So there's a lot to go around there. But I think the Israelis have done a lot to disable those tunnels. They're going to keep seeking to destroy the Hamas leadership, which is important. They're going to keep seeking to destroy those military brigades of Hamas, which is important. But yes, it's not clear how the Philadelphia corridor is going to be secured. But people have been working on this for a long time. It's just never fully worked.
You know, it's so interesting. We keep hearing we want a ceasefire. All the candidates, the president, want a ceasefire. But isn't how they stop fighting going to be the reason why the fighting is going to be indicative of how long the ceasefire holds and peace has the best chance? You can't just stop.
No. Ceasefires are not always the answer. A ceasefire may ultimately be the answer in Gaza, not because of a ceasefire to get a ceasefire, but because the Israelis at some point are going to want to go to something that looks more like counterterrorism operations in and out of Gaza.
Yeah.
And I think what they are demonstrating right now is that in some ways the real front is against Hezbollah. And the question of how not to get overextended as you're dealing with Hezbollah is one that I think the IDF and the leadership in Israel is going to have to think about. It's also the case that it would be good to have what I called not a ceasefire but a humanitarian pause of a little time to get supplies in to Palestinians and so forth. But I want to turn back to Hezbollah for a second because when Al-Qaeda attacked us, I remember George Tenet, then the CIA director, saying that the A team of terrorism was Hezbollah. and what the Israelis have done in penetrating Hezbollah, in penetrating Iran with their intelligence, is really changing the strategic picture in the Middle East. And we should not be looking prematurely there for a ceasefire.
Here's what the Prime Minister Netanyahu said in an address to the directly to the Lebanese people. Cut 28.
We've degraded Hezbollah's capabilities. We took out thousands of terrorists, including Nasrallah himself and Nasrallah's replacement and the replacement of his replacement. Today, Hezbollah is weaker than it's been for many, many years. Now you, the Lebanese people, you stand at a significant crossroads. It is your choice. You can now take back your country. You can return it to a path of peace and prosperity.
Can they, though?
The Lebanese people are held hostage by Hezbollah as much as Israel is held hostage by Hezbollah. And this is a chance for the Lebanese people, for decent government to emerge in Lebanon. Hezbollah killed the Rafiq Hariri, who was the well-beloved prime minister of Lebanon.
Massive
in 2005.
Car bomb, right?
Massive car bomb. Hezbollah has refused to allow Lebanon to have elections for the last 2 years, despite the fact that the formula for how that needs to take place is very, very clear. And so to the degree that Hezbollah is weakened, Lebanon has a chance to be free. We are going to have to help the Lebanese army, which we've actually been training since 2005. But this is a chance for Lebanon to actually be out from under the thumb of the thugs, the drug runners, the terrorists that are Hezbollah.
Your contacts are great, but you're not on the ground in Lebanon. But right now there's a ground operation that the Israelis are going forward. They got to get their 80,000 people back in their homes in the north, and they got to make them feel safe. They might even put another division in, I understand. I don't know how big this army is. But there's that fear of 2006, that when they had such a hard time, even though they did tremendous damage, is that over? Have they learned a lot from that? Have you heard about tremendous progress?
I really can't answer it, Brian, and I don't think anybody can. I think the IDF has got to have an assessment of what they can achieve on the ground.
I guess how damaged this
is. Yeah, and it may look different than it did in 2006. In 2006, it looked like something that was really going to be very risky and not likely to succeed. Obviously, the Israeli, that's a democracy. And I have a very strong view. When a democracy is trying to create better security circumstances
right.
for itself, we should probably be the United States, the administration, somewhat less fulsome in our advice to them about how to do it. And we especially should not debate in the newspapers what the Israelis may or may not do.
So there seems intentional, a leak from our government into the Washington Post and New York Times about the moves, the objectives, and their objection to this. The leverage is it's our weapons. We should have a say. Mr. Secretary, you were there too.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about the leverage that we have?
First of all, you don't do this to an ally in the middle of a war that was not started by them, but started by terrorists who attack them. And what I mean by you don't do this about to them is could we stop debating whether they're going to go after Iranian nuclear sites? Could we stop debating are they planning to go after oil reserves? Could we stop debating how we feel about it? You know, Brian, you never knew that in 2006 we had very tough conversations with the Israelis about going in on the ground in Lebanon, but we had them in private. If you have concerns with the Israelis about what they're about to do, go have those discussions in private. But please don't leak it to the New York Times.
And we saw, I don't want to get you involved in politics, but I'll just tell you what everyone saw. We watched the president reluctant to talk to the press for 4 years. But two times over the next 4 days, when asked, what should the Iranians bomb? I wouldn't do oil fields. What should they bomb? Nuclear weapons, I would discourage that. I'm going to talk to him later. And then made it clear he's not even on speaking terms with the prime minister of Israel. He could have easily avoided those questions. He's been doing this for 50 years. That was intentional, don't you think?
Well, I'm not going to question motives here. I'm just going to say I didn't very much like the outcome.
Because you're an American.
Well, I'm an American, and I believe that when you have a democratic ally that's fighting an existential war, that you support them. And if you have concerns, which you're perfectly capable of having, perfectly legitimate to have those concerns, but have those concerns quietly. Have those concerns in conversation with your ally. Have those concerns behind the curtain, not out in front of it.
So we have a situation where last time I talked to you, I think the Ukrainian operation was underway and the invasion was supposed to be over. We had in 4 days, our president said to Zelensky, we'll give you a ride out. He goes, I don't want rides, I want weapons. And they fought gallantly. I have no doubt that we should be re-supporting Ukraine. I am very disturbed that a lot of Republicans don't think it's worth it, and maybe Bernie Sanders on the extreme left. I don't even know where that comes from. They're not a perfect democracy, but so what? Who is? They clearly want to be part of the West, and to me, they've earned it. And Zelensky has shown me tremendous leadership without any experience, tremendous instincts. Having said that, they're in Kursk. They have 25 million population. The Russians got 150 million population. What do you look to be the next step? Because Zelensky is presenting the West with his idea of an end game.
The end game is going to have to be one that the Ukrainians develop. Look, they have sacrificed immensely. And one thing that we have to remember is that they are fighting for their democracy, fighting for their freedom, fighting for their sovereignty. They haven't asked us to send a single soldier. They just asked us to give them the means to fight for themselves, and we should be doing that. Now, whether the end game will be the return of all territory or not, we'll see. But eventually there has to be a Ukraine that is prosperous, a Ukraine that is secure,
right,
and a Ukraine that is united. And we need to start talking with the Ukrainians about what that might look like. Brian, they have achieved some remarkable things. Do you know that they don't even have a navy? And thanks to their drone technology, they have pushed the Russian navy back from its bases in the Black Sea and reopened their ability to get grain through the Black Sea.
Helping Africa.
So that they've achieved some remarkable things. They continue to have an economy that's actually working in Kyiv and Lviv and in the western part of the country. And so at some point, the Ukrainians will have to decide what their objectives really are. We ought to be a part of that conversation. But for now, let's give them what they need so that the Russians can't achieve a breakthrough.
Your State Department, not Defense Department, but those fears of the military-industrial base taking over the country that Eisenhower has spoken about, it's not happening. In fact, it's not big enough.
We
have to expand it
in
order to get weapons to Taiwan, who pay for them, our allies who are willing to pay for them, and Ukraine that is taking an IOU for now.
Well, we have a problem, which is that our defense-industrial base has eroded.
Shrunk.
Our shipbuilding capability, we're decommissioning more ships than we're building right now. And so anybody who wants to be president of the United States had better have an answer to how we're going to rebuild our defense capability to deter war.
Do you think we
war through strong military capability?
And we always thought that, too. And by the way, this is not the first president who's had a problem with Israel. No, Reagan had a problem. And that's okay. Just, you know, we find about it later then, as opposed to in real time. He also didn't want the Israelis to bomb out the Iraqi nuclear program. Thank goodness they did. But looking right now, the Vladimir Putin that you know, is, from what you know and from people that have met with him lately, is that the same guy?
I don't think this is the Vladimir Putin that I knew. Now, I don't mean that he was ever a Jeffersonian Democrat, right? And he always had kind of two modes, oppress and humiliate. So in that sense, it's the same Vladimir Putin. But this Vladimir Putin, who has decided to act on his ambition to reestablish the Russian Empire, I think it's a Vladimir Putin who miscalculated as to how hard the Russians the Ukrainians would fight, miscalculated as to how strong his army was, and miscalculated as to what the Western response would be. And so we now have to make him pay for that risk, for that miscalculation.
I just don't know if he knows there's a way out. And one way out might be saying, okay, if we end here and they're in Russia, we have to be able to put up a barrier, almost like the Cold War Persian twos, to say if you go, if this is a tripwire, you're not allowed to take any more than the Donbas region.
I suspect they're thinking about a lot of things, but I'll just say one thing. Winter is about to come, and nobody will be able to move after November, December. We'll see where we are after that. But for now, let's supply the Ukrainians. Let's help them in any way that we can. And let's help them to make sure that Vladimir Putin pays a price for his miscalculation.
As a woman, what advice would you have for Kamala Harris? Are there certain people that are archaic in their views of men's and women's and genders? And did you get some of that?
You know, I never really felt it very much. Maybe I'm a little bit impervious for it. You know, Brian, I've been asked many times, would it have been different if you hadn't been a black woman? And I say to myself, I don't know. You know, I can't go invent myself as a white man. I did okay as a black woman. I would say just go do your job. Right? Just don't worry about if somebody looks a little bit askance. Don't worry about it if people think that you're less because you're – just let that be their problem, not your problem, and go and do your job.
That sounds like Booker T. Washington.
It is Booker T. Washington. It's also John W. Rice, Jr., who was my father, who told me that somebody else's prejudice is not your problem. That's their problem.
I agree. And you kept that philosophy the whole life, even though it was all around you as a kid.
I have. I've kept that philosophy.
You were here during the only minute left during the George Floyd riots and everyone examining and reparations and things like that. I think things are coming back around. Do you think we're in a better place now, race relations, than 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Well, I think we are in a better place than we were a few years ago, is that people still acknowledge the problems that we have. Look, America is not a perfect country, and we continue to have issues around race, particularly around race and poverty, and so we have to recognize that. But hopefully people are coming back to a more balanced view of America, an America that even if it was a slave-owning state at its beginning, has had a black president, has had black secretaries of state, an America that even if it had Jim Crow, let that little girl who grew up in Jim Crow grow up to be Secretary of State. So I think we're getting more balanced in how we think about America.
I'm so glad you stopped by. Condoleezza Rice, who's running the Hoover Institute over in Stanford, and the Secretary of State and former National Security Advisor. Thanks so much. Great to see you.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Back in a moment, Brian Kilmeade Show.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I went a little long, Martha, with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, but I'm able to hurt this segment. But I want you to weigh in on whether you think I was wrong to take her so long in my A block. Do you have any idea? We can still hear you.
Yeah. You can? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Hi there. How are we doing?
Good. So, yeah, we have a quick minute, then we got a full half hour. But your thoughts about it's going to be all hurricane, your coverage, right? Is it going to be by that time? Do you think it's going to hit landfall at 3 o'clock
Eastern? I don't think it will be until overnight. 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. is what we're looking at. But, you know, when these things happen, you dig in, you learn a lot more about how these kinds of immense hurricanes work. And there's just a ton of water churned up, which makes sense, obviously, in the Gulf, and can start pushing on earlier than that, earlier than when it hits. So very low-lying areas, you know, CENTCOM, all of these very big operations
in Tampa.
That area. That's right. And they have moved out a lot of our naval aircraft and ships from the region. Obviously, then you get a lot of federal effort in to help as well. So this is a very big deal, and we're just praying for everybody in the path.
Right. And Fort Myers again.
Yes.
I mean, it just got crushed 2 years ago.
I know. It is. I have friends in Tampa who left a few days ago and who never leave. I mean, they ride these things out, you know, they've been there for decades. And when they told me a few days ago that they were on their way up to Jacksonville, I thought this is a big deal.
All right. With Martha McCallum, we got some quality time left. We got to talk about what's happening, too, with this new Bob Woodward book.
Yeah. Very interesting.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What did you think of this thing that just came out today? That Bob Woodward's book was saying that Trump was sending COVID tests to Putin, and Putin said, don't let anyone know. I mean, this is, what is going on? What do you make of that?
So I actually said it even in the debate. I believe that Donald Trump has this desire to be a dictator. He admires strong men, and he gets played by them because he thinks that they're his friends.
Yeah.
And they are manipulating him full time and manipulating him by flattery.
So that is her answer to Howard Stern. One of the few times Howard Stern let her talk. Howard Stern totally lost his man card. He lost his mind during the pandemic. I know. I've been listening to him since high school. and I don't even recognize him. He is, in fact, he's, I think he's embarrassed by his past work. And every time he comes up and condemns things like all Trump voters, he says he hates all Trump voters. No, he didn't say I hate Trump. And I feel I hate all Trump voters. So you hate 70 million people, many of which were your listeners. And then they pop up all these things of him doing misogynistic things, him wearing blackface and all his crazy skits. And he looks like the biggest hypocrite in the world. Martha McCallum here, anchor of The Story, getting ready to start at 3 o'clock. But I just wanted you to hear that and talk a little bit about the Bob Woodward book. But I don't know the bottom line. The source for that, Martha, was one unnamed Trump staffer. Trump says, I don't know what you're talking about. But we did make it public that we did send Russia stuff, and no one really objected to it.
Yeah, and that's probably how that shakes out. I think it's very interesting when to listen to the vice president talk about people being sort of, you know, managed or handled by foreign leaders, and it just makes me think about Iran and the history of both the Obama administration and the Biden administration when it comes to losing our leverage with Iran. I also think about walking into Crimea. And it's interesting also in the Woodward book that Biden points to weakness in his opinion, if that's true, that's another element from the book, that Obama didn't take Putin seriously enough and didn't think he would go into
Obama,
Crimea.
Which he was vice president.
That's what I'm saying. So it's there's two administrations who maybe have been played by Iran and by Russia in a number of moves that really matter on the ground in terms of the geopolitical world that we live in.
So Biden called Netanyahu a effing liar. Bibi, what's your strategy? According to Woodward, he said, what's your strategy? He goes, well, I'm going into Rafah. He goes, well, what's your strategy going into Rafah? What do you mean, what is a strat? I can answer that. I have to eradicate every Hamas fighter possible, and most of them are located in Rafah. And by the way, the delay on Rafah could have cost some hostages their life because we telegraphed the whole thing and fought about it in public. What Condoleezza Rice did say is this. I won't get into politics, but I despise the leaking that goes on of private Israeli conversations with Americans. That undermines the whole military operation.
I think that's true. And I think that there are often probably strong words between leaders because these are extremely important moments and they should hash things out. Again, I don't know, was that, you know, is that story based on one source who says that this is what happened? So, I mean, Woodward's been around a long time. He generally has some good sources. I know it's clear that Lindsey Graham spoke to him for parts of this book. But I think the bigger picture is, and I agree with Secretary Rice, that we don't want to see these kinds of leaks because I think they do undermine presidents' abilities to talk to each other.
Right. So we'll see where this goes. We know this. I don't see anything leaking out about Harris. So if Woodward doesn't include anything about Harris in this book, that's a pure political ploy. Because you don't tell me her ineptness that was on display for 3.5 years, whether it's the border or anything else, her uselessness when she disappeared during Afghanistan. Do you know during when they made the announcement and Biden had to own up to the worst moment in modern American military history? She went to California. Mm-hmm. She didn't want any part of it. I mean, if she's not in this book, that's Bob Woodward saying, I want to make sure Trump's not president.
And it is a shame that we haven't seen any, you know, really strong debates or interviews to give her an opportunity to explain that. All she said was, yes, you know, I did support. I was the last person in the room on the Afghanistan decision, and I did support it. So she owns it. And we all know the dominoes that fell as a result of that weakness in Afghanistan. And you can just look to Ukraine. You can look to Israel and the tumultuous world that we live in right now.
All right, I want to talk about what happened at CBS.
Yeah.
So this guy, Ta-Nehisi Coates, did I say his first name right?
I believe so.
Yeah. So he writes this book and he's a best-selling author, believes in reparations, African-American guy, very good writer, but an extremist. And at CBS, when he came in to do his book, I imagine that they're the same publisher. Tony DiCoppo, who's on the same time as me, and so you probably have never seen him, Martha. He's on doing the morning show, and he asked some pointed questions to Ta-Nehisi Coates. Mm-hmm. And I think you should just hear some of the exchange because the fallout is astounding. Cut 36.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. Mm. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist.
Mm.
And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Mm. Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it? Mm. Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, mm. the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel in any condition has a right to exist?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world.
So I thought this is a good, interesting exchange. I would listen to it.
Absolutely.
What about you?
Absolutely.
Do you think the question was fair?
And you know what? Sadly, I'm thinking that this is the kind of conversation that we're getting used to hearing on really interesting podcasts, right? Where there's a very open exchange between people of very different opinions. And I think it's an interesting conversation. I don't think there's anything out of line in that. It's provocative. It's interesting that Tony DeCoppo, you know, wanted to nudge that line of inquiry with him. And he's a big boy. He can take that. He had interesting answers. And DeCoppo got scolded and said that he was breaking CBS ethics. They had a huge meeting. People were crying at this meeting over what's going on because he was reprimanded by basically the, you know, the DEI part of the mechanism that is CBS News. I am so shocked that we live in a world right. where the conversation we all just listened to is not allowed at CBS News.
But by the way, if he lost his temper, if Coates lost his temper, then would be, okay, what happened? This guest came in and he lost his temper. What happened? And then I would probably judge his reactions over the top. Mm. But he seemed to embrace the debate.
Yes, because if you as he should. He's an intellect. And he's also entitled to his opinion. Yeah. And he can write whatever he wants to write in his book.
And by the way,
that's the great thing about living in America.
And he'll sell it to all the protesters outside Columbia wearing the Yasser Arafat starter kit.
And who benefits from not hearing this conversation? This is a valid conversation that digs deeper than most places that you're going to really get into in, you know, the world we live in, where there's a lot of, you know, sort of surface treatment of this and people get their news on TikTok in 30-second, you know, snippets.
So here's more. Cut 37.
I wrote a 260-page book. It is not a treatise on the entirety of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
But if you were to read this book, you would be left wondering, why does any of Israel exist? What a horrific place, committing horrific acts on a daily basis. So I think the question is central and key. If Israel has a right to exist, and if your answer is no, then I guess the question becomes, why do the Palestinians have a right to exist? Why do 20 different Muslim countries have a right to exist?
My answer is that no country in this world establishes its ability to exist through rights. Countries establish their ability to exist through force, as America did. And so I think this question of right to Israel does exist. It's a fact. The question of its right is not a question that I would be faced with any other country.
So he's Jewish, I think, Tony DeCoppo, I guess. So he's,
I believe so.
So that's his, that's his point of view. It just seems to be, it seems like Coates has the view of those people protesting in the streets, most of the squad. That's where they feel. I mean, they feel like they're the big tough guys, and but I don't think that anybody who asked for a two-state solution really has taken any time to talk to either side, because neither one of them wanted a two-state solution.
Unfortunately, that's where we are right now. I think there are a lot of people who still believe that a two-state solution is possible, but that's not the moment that we're living in. And, you know, Hezbollah has been firing rockets into Israel for decades.
Oh, I just found out. Allison just told me his first wife and two kids live in Israel.
DeCoppo's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Use a little more. Cut 38.
But you write a book that delegitimizes the pillars of Israel. It seems like an effort to topple the whole building of it. So I come back to the question, and it's what I struggled with throughout this book. What is it that so particularly offends you about the existence of a Jewish state that is a Jewish safe place and not any of the other states out there?
There's nothing that offends me about a Jewish state. I am offended by the idea of states built on ethnocracy, no matter where they are.
Muslim included.
I would not want a state where any group of people laid down their citizenship rights based on ethnicity. The country of Israel is a state in which half the population exists on one tier of citizenship, and everybody else that's ruled by Israelis exist on another tier, including Palestinian-Israeli citizens. The only people that exist on that first tier are Israeli Jews. Why do we support that? Why is that okay? I'm the child of Jim Crow. I'm the child of people that were born into a country where that was exactly the case, of American apartheid. I walk over there, and I walk through the occupied territories, and I walk down a street in Hebron, and a guy says to me, I can't walk down the street unless I profess my religion. Okay. I'm with another power. No. I want to. This is very, very important.
It is important. It is
extremely important.
Yeah. Lay it down.
I'm working with the person that is guiding me is a Palestinian whose father, whose grandfather and grandmother was born in this town. And I have more freedom to walk than he does. He can't ride on certain roads. He can't get water in the same way that Israeli citizens who live less than a mile away from him can.
And why is
why
that?
Why is that okay?
Why is that?
You know, the answer is security. That's why. It's not that you're doing less. I have to worry about the next cafe blowing up being you, you know, you were in a body bomb.
Yeah, I find it a really interesting conversation. And I'm also thinking about the mullahs in Tehran and how that religious leadership dominates over the people, many of whom want to be free in Iran. I'm also thinking about the fact that on October 7th, you had kibbutzes where the people regularly volunteered in Gaza.
I know. They were the liberal ones.
You know, I have been to Israel. There are plenty of examples that pop into my mind of people living side by side with Palestinians and people of different faiths in harmony in Israel. It's certainly, you know, I can't say it's the case in every neighborhood and every person's experience, but it certainly is a reality in Israel. So, you know, I think it's a very interesting conversation. But the reason we're talking about it is because one party was reprimanded for having this conversation. And that is not a free press. That is not the America that any of us should be living in. This is a conversation that can't happen in a lot of countries, but it can happen here and it should happen here. And CBS should be elevating this exchange and saying, we're talking about real things on CBS News. They did the opposite. He was scolded and reprimanded for even having this conversation.
So Adrienne Roark is the one. Who is Adrienne Roark, Allison? Do you know who she is?
I think she's the president of CBS News.
So
right?
She's the president of CBS News. So this was a call that leaked out, a conference call that leaked out. Head of news gathering, excuse me. Okay. So listen to this exchange, cut 40.
Many of you have reached out to express concerns over recent reporting, specifically about the CBS Mornings Coates interview from last week, as well as comments made coming out of some of our correspondents' reporting. I want to thank every single one who reached out for your honesty, your transparency, and your commitment. So I want to address three things. Number one, after a review of our coverage, including the interview, it's clear there are times we have not met our editorial standards. Number two, this has been addressed, and it will continue to be in the future. And number three, I want to acknowledge and I want to apologize that it's taken this long to have this conversation. This is a highly charged and complex issue. I think we all know that. And it was really important for us, for Wendy, for me, to have the conversations, to take the time and the breath and think and then proceed in a calm and measured way.
What are you talking about? What standards? And you know what they did after? They hired a DEI expert to come down and talk to everyone. Then they found out the DEI guy had basically called Tim Scott and Uncle Tom and had these racial issues.
Make this up. And then this Dr. Grant was like, okay, well, you're not actually the right guy to have this sort of, you know, therapy session with everybody about how we're going to deal with this. And at this meeting that they had, apparently, you know, it turned into a complete chaotic environment that some of the employees were yelling. Shauna Thomas, the show's executive producer, was in tears, and so was DeCoupel over this discussion and raising this open debate about whether it is fair to talk about whether Israel should exist at all. Now, imagine, as they point out here in the Free Press, great piece by the Free Press, imagine if someone was saying, let's have a discussion about whether or not the United States should exist or Ukraine should exist, more relevant in our current moment, or that we should talk about Ukraine or that it's okay to defend Ukraine against Russia. That's where this is at.
Right. Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back. Martha, before we go, I need to know who's going to be on the show. Do you know for sure yet?
So we are going to have Deanna Criswell, the head of FEMA, on the show. So we'll talk to her. We're also going to have Lieutenant Commander Josh Rannenberg, who is NOAA hurricane hunter, has flown into the storm this morning. So we're going to talk to him about what that's like. What does it look like up there? And what should people be ready for?
Here's Deanna
Criswell. I also
have
my interview with Boris Johnson, which was so interesting. We did it yesterday. It's going to be a longer form podcast. But I thought his answers to a lot of my questions about what's going on in the world were really interesting.
I was so disappointed he imploded. Here's what the FEMA administration said in 2022. Deanna Criswell, cut three.
Goal number one of the strategic plan for FEMA is to instill equity as a foundation of emergency management.
It's a really important part of my vision when I came into the agency, and I'm happy to see how it's evolved through the development of our strategic plan. By creating this diverse workforce is incredibly...
I just wonder if her emphasis on that stopped her from having the best force possible. And I'm hoping eventually that mindset gets away. Do you think it's important?
I think that mindset is diminishing. I see companies across the country disbanding their DEI office because we all know that the best way to have leadership is to have it be blind to those issues and to impress people based on merit and how you do your job, regardless of what you look like.
I don't need an Indian transgender person to save me. I just need the best person
or
to
a really dumb white person.
Thank you.
You know, whoever's the
just
best person should do it.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.